Rollbacks to federal pollution control regulations have a downstream effect on Arkansas's energy landscape. Plus, we get an update on efforts to close the loop of the Arkansas River Trail system. And a whole week of events celebrating Arkansas's music industry is coming to Fayetteville. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. This year marks the 55th anniversary of President Richard Nixon signing the Clean Air Act into law. The landmark pollution control legislation has evolved since the 70s, and now the Trump administration is attempting to reduce its influence over private industry. This may be especially relevant to Arkansans, as the Clean Air Act affects energy development in the natural state, as well as the future of the White Bluff coal-fired power plant near Pine Bluff. KUAF's Jack Travis reached out to former Assistant Administrator of the EPA's Office of Air and Radiation, Joe Goffman, and Yale Economics Professor Janet Curie to learn more.
The Clean Air Act of 1963 was the first national law to control pollution by establishing a program within the U.S. Public Health Service and researching ways to monitor and mitigate particulate matter in American air. The 1967 Air Quality Act continued the expansion of federal activities and zeroed in on interstate pollution. And at about this same time, author and former EPA administrator Joe Goffman was coming of age in Philadelphia.
It was a big industrial town. And, you know, people just back in the 60s and 70s, you know, seemed to be getting sick a lot. And it was just at that time, you know, when I was going to college, that people really started to talk about air pollution.
He started paying attention. Goffman enrolled at Yale, graduated, and then attended Yale Law School. During that time, President Richard Nixon was demanding that Congress rework the Clean Air Act. A new version came around in 1970, and this law was different. The 1970 Clean Air Act established a comprehensive framework for pollution control by creating the Environmental Protection Agency, which Congress empowered to develop and enforce regulations. The government was now able to effectively limit emissions from both stationary or industrial sources and mobile sources like cars.
And I think people should know that the air they breathe is a lot cleaner and a lot less dangerous to their health than the air their parents breathed and even their grandparents breathed. And that's largely due to the Clean Air Act.
The Clean Air Act has come under recent scrutiny due to a landmark conclusion that much of modern environmental regulation is built around, called the endangerment finding. In 2009, the EPA found that greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide pose a threat to human health and welfare through their contributions to climate change.
EPA realized, well, cars may be the biggest source, but they're not of greenhouse gases, but there are other big sources, you know, power plants. Particularly power plants that burn coal, and to some extent, power plants that use natural gas.
So the EPA set to work, creating regulations for auto manufacturers and energy companies. Now, the agency is trying to repeal the endangerment finding and deregulate industries. According to a news release from the EPA, Administrator Lee Zeldin says this attempt to remove regulations is primarily motivated by economics and reinstating a free market for consumers. Goffman says these rescissions may actually have adverse effects on Americans' wallets.
Even if you look at what the agency, that is EPA, has said about what that's going to do to cost, it's going to add costs of, literally hundreds of billions of dollars to the economy.
In 2019, Yale economist Janet Curie co-authored a paper titled, "What Do Economists Have to Say About the Clean Air Act 50 years after the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency." More than 5 years later, she holds the same estimations.
I would say the benefits have greatly outweighed the cost. And part of that is because the costs have been smaller than people thought they would be. And at the same time, the benefits have been much larger than people thought they would be.
Curry says people tend to think of the costs of environmental regulations in terms of jobs lost and increasing the price of energy and products. However, private industries are adaptable.
So there is innovation in clean technologies when there's an incentive to have innovation, and then that lowers the cost of complying with these kinds of mandates.
Costs also manifest through public health. According to the World Health Organization, breathing polluted air can cause asthma, heart disease, strokes, and even lung cancer. Of course, the Clean Air Act is not perfect. Curie says the EPA missed opportunities to tailor regulations to specific communities or industries, or even help families relocate when a dirty plant dominates a local economy, as pollution disproportionately affects low-income areas. Back in the natural state, these debates are more than abstract. Entergy's White Bluff Steam Station near Pine Bluff is one of the largest coal plants in the state and faces questions about its future. Under the Clean Air Act's Regional Haze Program, a framework protecting visibility at national parks, the plant was going to have to undergo a $1 billion update to meet new standards. Entergy decided to decommission the plant instead. The Trump administration is attempting to repeal the Regional Haze Program, just like the endangerment finding. For Arkansans, Entergy's White Bluff Steam Station is a reminder that the Clean Air Act isn't just history. It's a living policy that shapes the air people breathe, the jobs they hold, and the bills they pay. The EPA is currently accepting public comment on repealing the endangerment finding through September 22nd.
That was KUAF's Jack Travis reporting. You can hear an extended cut of his story at KUAF.com. Cyclists, runners, and pedestrians have taken to the Arkansas River Trail for more than a decade now. It's a roughly 16-mile loop of trails encircling Little Rock and North Little Rock, except it's not technically a complete loop. I spoke with Arkansas Times reporter Milo Strain about his story looking at why there's still one stretch of unfinished trail, leading to calls of close the loop from Central Arkansas trail goers.
Just for those of us who don't know or maybe have never been to Central Arkansas, describe to us, what is the Arkansas River Trail? Where does it go? How did it come about? Sort of what purpose does it serve?
So it's this network of trails in Central Arkansas. They're multi-use. Pedestrians use them, bikers use them, and they're meant to sort of go all over the Central Arkansas area with this grand loop sort of as the centerpiece, which is I think it's like 15 miles on both sides of the Arkansas River. And it's sort of touted as like kind of the grand jewel of the whole trail complex, but it's never actually been fully completed. There's always been a section of the loop that has been unfinished for the over 20 years that the trail has been open. And the city and various stakeholders have sort of kind of been in talks that whole time to try and close it and never been able to find a solution. And those sort of stakeholders include Dillard's, which has its headquarters right in the area where they haven't been able to close the loop. And then to a lesser extent, Episcopal Collegiate School, but they're sort of not as, it's really Dillard's is kind of the main stakeholder. And so the trail, it's this big thing, this big kind of centerpiece for the area that is often used in marketing materials by the city and the county. But a crucial part of it has never been finished is sort of the main idea of the story.
The sort of narrative here in Central Arkansas is that more or less this is Dillard's fault, like they are blocking the completion of this loop. I guess I just wanted to ask, you know, how much credence is there to that notion? Is it truly just Dillard's who's sort of blocking the completion of this loop?
Based on what I found out and what's put in the story, it was seemingly that way for quite a long time, years and years. I talked extensively to former mayor of Little Rock, Mark Stodola, who one of his big things was trying to close the loop, and he was never able to do it. And there was always sort of rumors that it was Dillard's who would like not play ball with him and wasn't sort of coming to the table in good faith. And I was never able to find that like reported or corroborated anywhere. But when I did, you know, in our interviews, Stodola did confirm that like just the very basic timeline is Stodola was pushing to close the loop. He had hired an engineering firm to do some preliminary work and had come up with a couple of mock-ups and had gone to, they had an initial meeting with Dillard's. And after that, Stodola was never able to get them on the phone, never able to find out why. They just sort of dropped out of negotiations. And it basically ended there because they are on the land that where they need to close the loop. And it gets more complicated than that. Like there's kind of the aspect of like the city owning the land, and we can get into that if you want, but that's kind of the basic, it was the story for a long time. One thing that was pretty surprising to me and ended up becoming like a pretty major part of my story is that in talking to Mayor Frank Scott's people, the current mayor, apparently that has changed. Dillard's is now back at the table. They're having meetings with the city. They're in talks. And apparently, what Scott's administration told me was that now the biggest issue is just finding money to get it done. Not necessarily Dillard's is like, they're not really at this point anymore the thing blocking it from happening, from what they told me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that is the big question now, is where do we go from here? I mean, how do we, obviously here in Little Rock, Mayor Scott has tried numerous times and failed to get sales taxes passed to fund not necessarily the River Trail, but big infrastructure projects, things like community centers, sports arenas, things like that. What possible way can the city fund this now?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't know, like, specific grants or anything they could apply for. And, well, like, that's kind of a question now, too. With, you know, you would think there would be, like, federal grants that would for infrastructure at the local level. I mean, the current presidential administration is not really funding things like that right now. I don't really know the specific ins and outs of that. But I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the question, that's always the kind of the question with big projects like this is where do you get the money? And they seem to be finding money for other things. Like I know they just spent, it was like $5 million or something on the study for this other park, the Deck Park. I would say they would need to look for a grant of some kind, they've tried to pass a sales tax, that didn't work. Maybe like a benevolent private benefactor of some kind will come out of nowhere. Like I know in Bentonville the Waltons have funded all kinds of bicycle infrastructure, but at the moment, that is just kind of the big question is where, because they've already spent money on engineering work. They've got 5 different plans that they can go with, and they've spent the money on those. There's just no money to actually build them yet.
I am glad you mentioned the plans that are floating around for closing the loop. Those were pretty interesting to me. Do you mind describing those?
Sure, yeah. So there's 5 different plans. They range in construction costs from $8 to $18 million. Each one is like a different combination of like either going over the driveways into Dillard's headquarters or going under, or and then going back behind the 1836 Club and the Dillard's IT building. When I talk to like local bike advocates in the city, the one they're most excited about is the 5th plan. It would go, I think, above one of the Dillard's driveways, under the other, with a tunnel and a bridge, and then cut behind the 1836 Club and the IT building, and then link back up with the rest of the trail. But all the plans are basically a variation of that.
What have you heard from everyday people who use the River Trail about, like, what is their current experience using the River Trail in this gap, and how hopeful are they that there's an appetite within the city government to fund a project like this?
So in terms of like experience on the trail, the people I talk to, the group is called Bicycle Advocacy of Central Arkansas. When they talk to new bikers and stuff, they tell them to not even ride on the Little Rock side, for example, like because the North Little Rock side is so much easier to navigate. Like one of the things they told me, I don't think this made it into the story, but the bike rental store in the River Market, they're on the Little Rock side, but when they rent bikes to people, when they ask about the river trail, they tell them not to go down the Little Rock side, across the bridge, go over on that side. Yeah, it's rough. You get to that spot and it's very confusing because there are also like older signs there from like previous attempts to route the trail. There's a lot of discussion about it online too. Like that was part of, I would go on like the Little Rock subreddit, and if you just search closing the loop, there's posts going back like over 10 years. People are optimistic, I think, but I don't think anyone really has their hopes up either after just so many years of the loop not being closed. This current kind of push to get it closed again, I think people are hopeful, but keeping their expectations realistic.
That was Arkansas Times reporter Milo Strain talking about his story on efforts to close the loop of the Arkansas River Trail. You can read his full story online at arctimes.com. A first-of-its-kind conference celebrating the live music of the natural state is coming to Northwest Arkansas. The inaugural Arkansas Music Week is set for September 14th through the 21st in Fayetteville. It's presented by Arkansas Music Experience in partnership with Experience Fayetteville and the Downtown Fayetteville Coalition. Travis Smith with the Arkansas Music Experience spoke about the festival with KASU's Marty Scarborough.
Well, something that I've noticed, especially in, say, even just the last 18 months, there have been a lot of initiatives lately to make people more aware of the Arkansas music scene. If you had to describe what Arkansas music is, where would you even begin?
When I think about what it has been for the longest time, I always think of people, you know, like the band and, you know, like the Cape Brothers, a little bit of R&B, soul, funk, a little bit of everything. But then, you know, the younger generation that's probably my age and younger is going, you know, there's some folk singers and country folks that used to be in metal bands. So it's a little, when I think about my elders, it's a little bit more on the Americana side, but then there's a lot of rock and metal that jumps across different genres. So for me, I think Arkansas, just where we're being located, is a kind of hodgepodge of a lot of genres. We don't really have one genre that dominates, but more of a mixture of.
Well, it certainly sounds like this event is one in which musicians and those who are involved in the Arkansas music industry can network with one another. But beyond that, it's also an event just for music fans, right?
Yeah. The way that we see it is, if you're an alien that got dropped down and somewhere around the area for a week, then you should be able to leave with a pretty good idea of the variety of talent that we have here. So yeah, there's definitely a little bit of everything. And we've tried to do that too. If we see something that's not represented, I've reached out to venues and been like, hey, can we get this style of music or this, you know, a certain demographic or age group represented at this event as well. So that's something that we've been mindful of as well.
Really briefly, I do want to hit some of the highlights because you've got so many fantastic things happening mm-hmm. that week. It's going to be kicking off with a Sunday on the Square event in Fayetteville Square. Tell us a little bit about what that's about.
So we have Sundays on the Square. We used to have First Thursdays. This is the, you know, Experience Fayetteville and working with Downtown Fayetteville Coalition puts on event with vendors and local folks. And this has moved to Sundays a few times every year. And we have been working with Experience Fayetteville and Downtown Fayetteville Coalition, who's been great to work with on this. And they said, what do you think about anything there? And so we chatted about the opportunity for artists and music entities, if you make instruments or something, to be able to come and set up a booth at that event and then be able to sell your merchandise, your products, your services, or whatever you may have. So that's kind of what the music industry or the music yard sale, if you will, is at that event.
Beyond that, then you've got what's being called the Fayetteville Music Cities Convention happening Tuesday the 16th through mm-hmm. Thursday the 18th. How is that different than what's happening that Sunday before?
I would say the Music Cities Convention, that's going to be a lot of people that produce festivals, that work with municipalities, and those that work, not the actual production of like setting up the stage and stuff, but like kind of the behind the scenes and the decision makers, policy makers and stuff like that. So that's going to have a lot of people, honestly, from all over the world that are in town that do things very similar to this in their own area. And so they'll be coming here, and it's a chance for us to kind of engage with people in different areas that do something a little bit different. So I would say Music Cities has some local delegates that are going to be there, but it's honestly people coming in from all over the world on that.
Well, there is going to be another event that's going to allow people to network within the music industry, and that's what's being called the Music Industry Meetup, happening at George's Majestic Lounge that Tuesday night at 6. I assume that's just sort of something similar, but maybe for a little bit more local people?
Yeah, this is something that we did. Robbie Kim and I used to do these back in Shindig when we had that entity before the pandemic. So we did probably 4 or 5 of them, I feel like 4 maybe. Before then, and we always had about 150, 200, 250 people show up. And it's, you come, you set up your booth. Nothing's really sold. You can sell something, but nobody really ever does. You can hand out flyers and stuff like that. It's a good place to promote something, but you can sign up, bring a table, set up your entity. And then, you know, we've been playing music and stuff around here, so we can get our music friends to show up. It's having something that we get everybody in the room so you can see what studios are here, who's shooting videos, who's doing graphics, and who is looking to collaborate with artists and kind of build a little bit of collaborations, if you will, to see if we can't help throw some fire on our little local industry here. So that's kind of what the Music Industry Meetup, a free engagement that if you want to come in and meet everybody that's doing stuff, but meet people that are also playing music and stuff like that, it's a good event for that.
Well, and there's so many great live musical events happening throughout the week. If someone would like to maybe find a list of what all of these events are going to be, where can they go online to engage with that?
We have a whole list of everything that's going on Experience Fayetteville's website. If you just go to experiencefayetteville.com, you'll see something for the music week. If you click on that, you'll be able to go down and it's got day by day, who's presenting what time it is, what to expect at that event. We'll probably be adding some more events. We've had some people reach out to ask how they could be a part, and say probably within a week or so, we'll have probably 6 to 10 more events added, I would imagine.
Well, this being the first time you're doing the Arkansas Music Week, what are some goals you have for this first time? And then maybe plans to even expand it further in the future?
Our goal is to keep it as manageable as possible, obviously. But, you know, for us, we're looking at, we have big picture, obviously, plans and stuff like that. I think our main goal is to really throw as much fire on this first year as possible. Like, I have a music festival and I've worked with events long enough that if you don't kind of throw everything you got coming out of the gate swinging, and you know, for me as an event planner, I look at, can we put as many engagement opportunities for artists to engage with each other, but as well as their fans, and then recreate that over and over. So I think for us, the main thing, you know, hopefully we're having something where we're getting anywhere from 20, 40, 50,000 people in for a week to come and maybe see some national acts from Arkansas. Maybe see, we've got people like Jesse Wells and Sawyer Hill. That's like, you know, they probably live a couple miles from where I'm at right now, that probably, like, you know, these are great champions for our state. So I think being able to get everybody in one spot, it's something that's happened before, but some people's blown up and some people's kind of moved and stuff like that. So for us, it's, if everybody in the state of Arkansas that's like doing stuff with music can all meet up in one spot and represent the state, you know, that's kind of the goal.
That was Travis Smith with the Arkansas Music Experience talking about the inaugural Arkansas Music Week happening in Fayetteville from September 14th through the 21st. He spoke with KESU's Marty Scarborough. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Dean O'Brien, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.